I thank you very much, President Obama. Appreciate your speech, and I agree we do need to make sure that people have jobs, bring jobs back to America, the ones that we've lost, and train people who cannot find gainful employment in their previously chosen fields. We do have a caller. I was going to play I've Been to the Mountaintop. I'm sorry. I was going to play the speech from the March on Washington, I Have a Dream speech. But I think it's Herb. Haven't heard from Herb this year. I do try to take callers as quickly as I can when they call. So let's go to the phones. Caller, you're on the air. Who's this? Is this Herb? Am I right?
Good morning, Hal.
Hey, Herb.
Happy New Year.
Happy Martin Luther King Day. Thank you. And Happy New Year. That's right. We haven't spoken in the New Year. What's on your mind, my friend?
Yeah, Martin Luther King, one of the greatest people. And he got a huge part of his inspiration from Henry David Thoreau, who was very eloquent about speaking with action, you know, like conscientious objection, life without principle,
On civil disobedience. I think on civil disobedience. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah. There was another title for it, Life Without Principle. So Martin Luther King, he spoke about the triple axis of evil. The racism and the classism and the militarism. And I think he might have applauded Obama for helping to bring the sailors home, but I think he would have condemned the war-making.
I'm with you. I think he would have been very harshly critical of the drone program. I don't think there's any question about it. I think he would have called to have our daughters and sons brought home as quickly as possible. He spoke so often about Vietnam. I think you're absolutely right. I think he would have seen the wars in the Middle East in a similar light, Herb, no question about it.
He said that a nation that that spends more on the military than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death, and that was almost 50 years ago. So his words ring as true today as they ever did.
No question.
And that's why it's really, I think it's totally integral to Bernie Sanders' success. If he were to drop his militarism, that would go a long way towards making him a true candidate for the people.
Well, I think he's far less militaristic than the other candidates. You and I argue this point. I don't really want to get into it today since we're trying to speak positively of Dr. King. But I think that if you're voting for the least militaristic candidate, you'd have to vote for Sanders. Or perhaps you could say Rand Paul. I'll give Paul that. Paul has been, you know, very consistent.
Who the Greens bring out, or, you know, some of the other parties. Because I feel that it's definitely time for people to vote their conscience.
Well, you have to vote your conscience at the same time as making and I know you'll disagree with this, Herb, but so be it, still making a sober judgment over who is truly capable of winning, who is truly electable. I think the primaries are the time when you vote your conscience, you vote your heart. If a candidate can win a primary, the primary, be the nominee of the party, then I think that candidate we have to assume, if it's one of the two major parties, that candidate can win the election. People said about Obama, he can't win. That was Hillary Clinton's argument. She played the race card, that white working voters prefer her. And the message was clear in the general election. They will not support Obama. They will vote for the Republican. And it was false. It was a lie. It was not true. So I think when you look in each primary, you vote your conscience. But when it comes to the general election, you have to make a sober judgment. Is this candidate truly electable? And is this candidate decent enough for me to support?
Well, the first part is primary. In other words, it supersedes the second part.
Which part is that?
I mean, the second part
is primary.
Is primary. It supersedes the first.
Well,
part.
I agree. I don't think you should vote for a bad candidate unless the alternative is absolutely a Nazi. Unless the alternative is a Ted Cruz, then sometimes you have to say, well, look, I don't like this guy. He's not good. I don't like this woman. She's not great. She's Margaret Thatcher, and that's not a good thing. But it's still better than voting for, you know, Hitler, Stalin, Mao. You know, I mean, that's kind of what you have to say sometimes. And if you look at this Cruz person, he's just evil. He's just evil, Sean. And then Herb. Why did I say Sean? Herb. He's just evil. And I think that's something that you have to factor in. I mean, he's talking
like
about carpet bombing right now. He wants to carpet bomb. He said he wants to find out whether sand glows in the dark.
Well, he's a ridiculous hothead. But then you look at Obama, and he's providing cluster munitions to Saudi Arabia to bomb, you know, on the Yemeni people.
Yeah, I'm not happy with that aspect of the
You know,
Obama
so,
presidency.
You know, people voted for Obama because he was better than... Well, who is the latest one? Romney.
But, yeah, it's a fair point. It's a fair point. This is one area where Obama is not good. It's very, very problematic. I hate to say he's bad, but it's really hard to defend the Kill Tuesdays, right? When they have those Kill Tuesdays, right? They say who we're going to kill.
Sad.
It's pretty awful.
And Hillary Clinton was all in on that too, so.
She wants more bombing. Yeah. She's been real clear. That's what she wants, more bombs, more troops. She is the wrong choice, Herb. You're absolutely right.
I think that each of us owe it to ourselves to maybe read some of Martin Luther King's speeches. And really, you know, because you hear sound clips and everything and gives a taste, but to really get the full meal, there's a lot of food for thought there. Like the letter from Birmingham jail and, you know, all sorts of speeches that he gave. And
everything he wrote and said is tremendous. I agree with that. And that's where I think Obama is, firmly in the legacy of Dr. King, because Obama does speak so well and write beautiful speeches and deliver them beautifully. But I think your point that he doesn't always walk the walk, Herb, is, you know, it's fair. I can't argue it. I appreciate the call. I'll let you go, Herb, at this point. Thank you for that call on this Dr. King Day. I guess where we disagree is that I think this president has done a lot of really good things too. And although they can't wipe out the bad, still more and more Americans are working, in part because of the president's policy. More and more Americans have health care because of the president's championing of the Affordable Care Act. And those are well within the legacy of Dr. King. All right, we do have a break coming up. I did want to play Dr. King's speech, but look, when you're thinking about all that Hillary Clinton has done wrong, all the lies, the dishonesty, and it may work, you know, she may get the nomination. She's got a poll out there, came out last afternoon. I was very, very upset when I saw it. I told you Friday that Bernie's surge, Bernmentum, really was a double-edged sword for me. On the one hand, I was excited about it. I was like, oh my gosh, maybe he'll win. Maybe we'll finally get somebody who champions the economic interests of the 99%, who truly is on our side, not merely on our side when it's in her best interest, when she needs to be on our side politically, but truly is on our side. And the sword, the other side of that sword is, we could lose. You know, you feel like you can taste something. It's you're starving, you're famished, you're dying of thirst, and somebody offers you a delicious meal or a canteen filled with cold water, and just as it's getting to your lips, it's swiped away from you. And that's how I felt when I saw the poll from NBC Wall Street Journal poll that showed Clinton up 20 5 points nationally. I'll talk about that poll later, but I'm going to, I promise, play the I Have a Dream speech coming out of this break. Thank you so much for listening to the Hal Ginsberg Morning Show.
All over this land.
So a little bit of a glitch there on my end. Nothing wrong on my system, which is working nicely, but I just took a little time to get to the break. So let's go to a Scientific American rather than Workers Independent News. We'll come out. We will play Dr. King after the... I guess there's no market report. It is... the markets are closed on this national holiday, Dr. King Day. So quick Scientific American, give me a moment to pause and refresh, and then we'll come back with Dr. King.
This is Scientific American's 60 Second Science. I'm Karen Hopkin. This will just take a minute. Chimpanzees. They're notoriously social creatures. They snack together, snooze together, and work hard to keep each other flea and tick-free. But this simian intimacy does more than just spread the love. It also helps to spread the bacteria that inhabit their guts, which is a good thing. That's according to a new study in the journal Science Advances. When we think about the germs that get swapped during social interactions, we tend to focus on the bad guys, the bugs that cause everything from Ebola to the common cold. But could togetherness also promote the exchange of health-promoting microbes, like those in the intestine? To find out, researchers spent 8 years scooping the poop from a troop of 40 chimpanzees in Tanzania, and they analyzed the bacteria present in the samples. What they found was that during the rainy season, when food is plentiful and the chimps are more chummy, the apes harbor an increased number of different bacterial species in their bellies, more microbiodiversity, if you will, which could make them more resistant to infections. And the chimps' increased microbe load was not due to them all eating the same stuff. In fact, the more time the animals spent together, the more varied they were in terms of how much fruit they consumed. The researchers say it's thus likely the hobnobbing chimps are indeed sharing the microbial wealth while they're grooming or mating, or when they're otherwise too busy to watch where they step. Thanks for the minute. For Scientific American's 60 Second Science, I'm Karen Hopkin.
At this time, I have the honor to present to you the moral leader of our nation. I have the pleasure to present to you Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr.
I am happy to join with you today in what will go down in history as the greatest demonstration for freedom in the history of our nation. Five score years ago, a great American in whose symbolic shadow we stand today signed the Emancipation Proclamation. This momentous decree came as a great beacon light of hope to millions of Negro slaves who had been seared in the flames of withering injustice. It came as a joyous daybreak to end the long night of their captivity. But 100 years later, the Negro still is not free. 100 years later, the life of the Negro is still sadly crippled by the manacles of segregation and the chains of discrimination. 100 years later, the Negro lives on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. 100 years later, the
The Negro is still languished in the corners of American society and finds himself in exile in his own land. And so we've come here today to dramatize a shameful condition. In a sense, we've come to our nation's capital to cash a check. When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir. This note was a promise that all men, yes, black men as well as white men, would be guaranteed the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note insofar as her citizens of color are concerned. Instead of honoring this sacred obligation, America has given the Negro people a bad check, a check which has come back marked insufficient funds. But we refuse to believe that the Bank of Justice is bankrupt. We refuse to believe that there are insufficient funds in the great vaults of opportunity of this nation. So we've come to cash this check, a check that will give us upon demand the riches of freedom and the security of justice. We have also come to this hallowed spot to remind America of the fierce urgency of now. This is no time to engage in the luxury of cooling off or to take the tranquilizing drug of gradualism. Now is the time to make real the promises of democracy. Now is the time to rise from the dark and desolate valley of segregation to the sunlit path of racial justice. Now is the time to lift our nation from the quicksands of racial injustice to the solid rock of brotherhood. Now is the time to make justice a reality for all of God's children. It would be fatal for the nation to overlook the urgency of the moment. This sweltering summit of the Negro's legitimate discontent will not pass until that is an invigorating autumn of freedom and equality. 1963 is not an end, but a beginning. Those who hope that the Negro needed to blow off steam and will now be content will have a rude awakening if the nation returns to business as usual. There will be neither rest nor tranquility in America until the Negro is granted his citizenship rights. The whirlwinds of revolt will continue to shake the foundations of our nation until the bright day of justice emerges. But that is something that I must say to my people who stand on the warm threshold which leads into the palace of justice. In the process of gaining our rightful place, we must not be guilty of wrongful deeds. Let us not seek to satisfy our thirst for freedom by drinking from the cup of bitterness and hatred. We must forever conduct our struggle on the high plane of dignity and discipline. We must not allow our creative protests to degenerate into physical violence. Again and again, we must rise to the majestic heights of meeting physical force with soul force. The marvelous new militancy which has engulfed the Negro community must not lead us to a distrust of all white people. For many of our white brothers, as evidenced by their presence here today, have come to realize that their destiny is tied up with our destiny. And they have come to realize that their freedom is inextricably bound to our freedom. We cannot walk alone. And as we walk, we must make the pledge that we shall always march ahead. We cannot turn back. There are those who are asking the devotees of civil rights, when will you be satisfied? We can never be satisfied as long as the Negro is the victim of the unspeakable horrors of police brutality. We can never be satisfied. As long as our bodies, heavy with the fatigue of travel, cannot gain lodging in the motels of the highways and the hotels of the cities. We cannot be satisfied as long as the Negro's basic mobility is from a smaller ghetto to a larger one. We can never be satisfied as long as our children are stripped of their selfhood and robbed of their dignity by signs stating for whites only. We cannot be satisfied as long as a Negro in Mississippi cannot vote and a Negro in New York believes he has nothing for which to vote. No, we are not satisfied, and we will not be satisfied until justice rolls down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. I am not unmindful that some of you have come here out of great trials and tribulations. Some of you have come fresh from narrow jail cells. Some of you have come from areas where your quest for freedom left you battered by the storms of persecution and staggered by the winds of police brutality. You have been the veterans of creative suffering. Continue to work with the faith that unearned suffering is redemptive. Go back to Mississippi. Go back to Alabama. Go back to South Carolina. Go back to Georgia. Go back to Louisiana. Go back to the slums and ghettos of our northern cities. Knowing that somehow this situation can and will be changed, let us not wallow in the valley of despair. I say to you today, my friend, so even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day, even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day, down in Alabama, with its vicious racists, with its governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification, one day right there in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted, and every hill and mountain shall be made low, the rough places will be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. This is our hope. This is the faith that I go back to the South with. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to work together, to pray together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom together, knowing that we will be free one day. This will be the day. This will be the day when all of God's children be able to sing with new meaning, "My country, 'tis of thee." Sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrim's cry. From every mountainside, let freedom ring. And if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. And so let freedom ring. From the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire, let freedom ring. From the mighty mountains of New York, let freedom ring. From the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania, let freedom ring. From the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado, let freedom ring. From the curvaceous slopes of California. But not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside. Let freedom ring, and when this happens, and when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last."
Say to America is be true to what you said.
We shall overcome.
All right, tremendous speech there by Dr. King. Just finished off with a little Joan Baez, and we'll Just a few thoughts before we hit a break that I just hit me while I was listening again to the We Shall Overcome speech, the I Have a Dream speech. When he talked about the tranquilizing drug of gradualism, we must avoid that. We cannot accept half a loaf. We may take the half a loaf, but we don't accept it. We say, this is, for now, the best we can get, but we're going to keep pushing for more. I think that's incredibly important. I think that is so obvious when we think about Obamacare. It was the best we could get, I believe that. But it wasn't nearly good enough. And now is not the time when our brothers and sisters, let me try to channel Dr. King, I could never be a quarter as powerful as he is as an orator. But let me try to channel him when so many millions of our American brothers and sisters have no health care at all, are being denied, when the insurance companies and the Wall Street brokers are getting richer and richer off of our diseases, when 55% of the people who live in Mississippi are obese, now is not the time to say, well, we'll try to improve Obamacare around the edges. Now is the time to demand universal single-payer health coverage provided by us, paid for with a tax that is progressive, that is paid for by the richest, the most powerful, those who have taken so much from us for so long. Now is the time to demand it, not to accept half measures, not to accept gradualism. We cannot be satisfied, as Dr. King said, with the status quo. We cannot continue down a path which is leading to more of us being employed, but also more and more wealth going to fewer and fewer people. We cannot be satisfied with a world where 62 people have more than 3 billion. We cannot be satisfied in a country where 1% have more than 42%. Where 1% have 42% and more than 80% have. We cannot be satisfied with that. 9:52, Dr. King Day, January 18. You're listening to the Hal Ginsberg Morning Show, 2016, at halginsberg.com, at radiomonterey.com.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Eric Wustewall. While discussing the upcoming season of Sesame Street that will premiere on HBO, Fox News' The Five co-host Eric Bolling refers to the children's show as a left-wing communist diatribe, much to the surprise of his co-host Juan Williams.
The 46th season of Sesame Street starts Saturday, but not on PBS this time. It's on HBO. And there are going to be big changes for Oscar, Big Bird, and Cookie Monster. Now you can get the show on mobile devices. It's only going to be half an hour, not an hour, and fewer characters. Also, guess what? Cookie Monster, better diet. Maybe some vegan food.
Oh, they got more people. The left-wing communist.
Oh, communist.
Diatribe they put out every single day.
I didn't know about that.
It's not the first time Bolling has taken issue with Sesame Street. Previously, Bolling has attacked government subsidies for PBS's Sesame Street, deriding Big Bird as a taker,
you know, Governor,
living on $6 million a year of taxpayer largesse. For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
I'm sorry for that little interruption there. I just was going to the Democratic debate to respond, really, as a call and response to Dr. King and his immortal, timeless, classic, profound words. How he elevates the people over everything else. And just comparing that right now with the candidates running for president, how there's one who does put the people first. And we'll get to that moment from the debate. I just want to make a couple points before we go there. Yeah, check out my website, halginsburg.com. I got a bunch up there, a whole lot of writing, and it really is all about how, you know, and maybe some of it is what's the word? It's implicit. It's not all explicit. Clinton and Sanders on guns and healthcare. Black Lives Matter feels the burn. Explaining white working class Republicans or why Bernie is best. And all of those, I think, implicit is that without any question, Dr. King would support Bernie Sanders for president. That Bernie Sanders, who marched, is there's no surprise. There can be no, doubt that when you look at the candidates today, that Bernie Sanders is the logical extension of. He is Dr. King's Dr. King is his muse. He's still Bernie Sanders' muse all these years later. And you can see it in the respect and dignity that only Sanders affords working people, poor people, all Americans. Whether it's his call for universal single-payer health coverage and his respect for your intelligence. His belief that you will understand that this is the most affordable, the most efficient, the most human, the most humane way for all of us to get what we deserve because we're human beings. Treatment when we're sick, when we're injured, wellness visits, care when we're seniors, dignity throughout our lives. That is Dr. King's message. Black Lives Matter feels the burn. I have been as critical as anyone on the left of Black Lives Matter in the past because I have not seen in them necessarily a willingness in the past to put the best interests of all above what I think they sometimes, what I would call sometimes narrow parochial interests. Well, I was wrong. Black Lives Matter put whatever I had a problem with well behind them. Sean King with a beautiful op-ed in the Daily News, the New York Daily News on Friday, endorsing Bernie Sanders and without question demonstrating in his articulation of Bernie Sanders and Bernie Sanders' platform and what Bernie Sanders wants and why Bernie Sanders is the best candidate, how Bernie Sanders is the legacy, is Dr. King's legacy writ large. You need to read it. You need to read what Sean King has to say. I do post King, Black Lives Matter Feels the Burn, and in it I link to Sean King's op-ed, and he certainly refers to the legacy of the civil rights movement. This is just no question that when you hear what Dr. King had to say, that he would support Bernie Sanders for president. 844-4-HELG. We're going to go to a break in a few moments, and we'll come back. We're going to talk about something that this president did that would never happen. Would never have happened if we had a Republican president. And that is negotiating peace with Iran, negotiating justice with Iran. So we'll talk to Paul Kawika Martin from Peace Action Network, and I don't think there's a better day to do that than on the day we have chosen to celebrate the life of one of the greatest of all Americans, Dr. Martin Luther King. And I just want to circle back when I started this conversation. I talked about whether King deserves to be the man of the century, the 20th century. And as much as I admire, how could you not admire this? The guy considered the second greatest scientist of all time, only Isaac Newton ahead of him. And what Einstein did was kind of decode the universe. But ultimately, it was zeros and ones. It was numbers. It was laws of physics. Dr. King was our human leader. I almost think we have to put that above the ones, the zeros, the math. I'll be back after this. Thanks so much for listening to The Morning Show. I'm Hal Ginsberg.
It's Thursday, January 14, 2016.
60 years ago, when the Russians beat us into space, we didn't deny Sputnik was up there.
Green News Report special coverage. President Obama's final State of the Union address. What he said, what he didn't, and the Republican response.
All of that and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
And for this final one, I'm going to try to make it a little shorter.
Fail, Mr. President. This is your Green News Report.
I know some of you are anxious to get back to Iowa.
Okay, Desi Doyen, I know you want to focus on Barack Obama's final State of the Union address, but before we get to that, some news out of Flint, Michigan. Michigan's Republican Governor Rick Snyder has finally, after I don't know how many months, requested federal assistance from FEMA to deal with the widespread toxic lead contamination in the water supply of Flint, Michigan, that was caused by Governor Rick Snyder's administration. So maybe some water and water filters to get the lead contamination out of the water is finally on its way to Flint?
It looks like it's finally on the way. He's activated the National Guard to deliver bottled water as well.
Take your time, Governor. And by the way, you ought to resign while you're at it. What do you have for us today, Desi Doyen?
Well, President Obama gave his final State of the Union address on Tuesday. He sought to draw a hopeful vision of the future for the country with major challenges ahead in coming decades.
You think?
Obama has devoted considerable time, more than any other president, to action on climate change. But in his speech, he first highlighted the successes of his broad-based energy policies, from the expansion of renewable energy to the boom in oil and natural gas drilling.
Emphasis on boom, I guess.
Wind power is now cheaper than dirtier conventional power. Solar is saving Americans tens of millions of dollars a year and employs more Americans than coal. Meanwhile, we've cut our imports of foreign oil by nearly 60% and cut carbon pollution more than any other country on Earth. Gas under $2 a gallon ain't bad either.
And, of course, cheap gas encourages consumers to burn even more gas, and that's the opposite of his stated goal of reducing the greenhouse gas emissions that cause dangerous climate change.
Yeah, but cheap gas is really popular, isn't it?
It is. And the boom in natural gas fracking,
there's that boom again,
has been the primary driver behind the decline in the use of coal for electricity during his administration, but it's also caused earthquakes and contaminated drinking water supplies.
Oh, there's that.
It's true, however, that the solar sector now employs more people than the coal or oil extraction industries.
Amazing. No wonder the Republicans hate it.
He didn't mention his landmark policy actions on climate change, like the Clean Power Plan, the first ever standards to reduce emissions from the nation's largest single source of emissions, power plants, or the historic emissions deal with China, or the fact that he implemented the first new fuel efficiency standards for the nation's cars and trucks in 40 years.
Yeah, the speech was long enough already, though, really, wasn't it?
Obama mocked the climate change science deniers in the Republican Party and used it to promote the economic benefits of transitioning to clean energy.
Look, if anybody still wants to dispute the science around climate change, have at it. You will be pretty lonely because you'll be debating our military, most of America's business leaders, the majority of the American people, almost the entire scientific community, and 200 nations around the world who agree it's a problem and intend to solve it. But even if the planet wasn't at stake, even if 2014 wasn't the warmest year on record, until 2015 turned out to be even hotter, why would we want to pass up the chance for American businesses to produce and sell the energy of the future?
That's a very good question, Desi Doyen. Why do Republicans want to pass that up?
I think because their major funders are the fossil fuel industry, and that's who they work for.
Not the solar industry, and not the wind industry.
Definitely not. Republican South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley delivered the Republican response. She criticized Obama on health care, the economy, immigration, and terrorism. And we would play for you what she said about climate and energy, but she didn't say anything on that or the booming U.S. clean energy economy.
Probably a smart idea.
This is the last State of the Union address for 2 years. By this time next year, we'll have a new president-elect and a new energy policy and climate agenda to look forward to.
Or, depending on who wins, to look backwards at. If you'd like to look forward or backwards at our coverage today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Don't forget, you can download our reports anytime via Stitcher, TuneIn, or iTunes, where we hope you'll give us a good review. Find us and follow us on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Well, this could be the last time. This could be the last time.
All right, back on the Ginsburg Show, 10:05 on January 18, Dr. Martin Luther King Day, and I'm very happy to share that day, share the air with Paul Kawika Martin from Peace Action Network. Peace Action issued a statement, I think, was it yesterday, celebrating the deal with Iran, Paul. Thank you for joining me this morning.
Thanks for having me, Hal.
Yeah, it's really a pleasure, and I mentioned during the break that we should at least acknowledge that it's appropriate to talk about peace through negotiations, the success of talking to our global adversaries, if we can use that term to describe Iran, and to come up with a solution that benefits both in the context of Dr. Martin Luther King's, the day we used to celebrate his life.
Indeed, he was very interested in the issue. Leaders from our organization marched with him. His wife was on our advisory board for a number of years. And I think his most important speech actually is one of his last, in which he drew the conclusion about we need to solve militarism and poverty and other issues. And he started moving away a little bit from the civil rights and started talking about peace and getting out of Vietnam.
All right, I mentioned the statement was yesterday, actually wrong. Again, Hal, it was on Saturday. Peace Action applauds Iran agreement success, urges similar diplomatic efforts with Syria and North Korea. We'll get to those other nations in a moment. But, Paul, tell us what happened on Saturday that we should be happy about.
Sure, just to take a couple of steps back. During the Bush administration, instead of trying to move towards some sort of dialogue with Iran, they went the opposite direction. So Iran had reached out, actually, to the U.S. several times to deal with some of the issues that we've had with them, and instead they were rebuffed by the Bush administration and put on the so-called axis of evil. And during that time, Iran came closest it could to the possibility of obtaining a nuclear weapon. It built up its centrifuges, it's built up other technologies. It didn't have necessarily a nuclear weapons program, but if it so desired, it could break out and get the fissile material to make a very crude bomb at the quickest point would be several months. So at the tail end of the Bush administration, some of his staff started to try to work with Iran. Nick Burns specifically, and during the Obama administration, they definitely went full steam ahead to have negotiations. So there was negotiations, it's called P5+1, permanent five in the UN, plus Germany and Iran, negotiated over a couple of years, and reached an agreement finally last July that set up a way to block all ways that Iran could get a nuclear weapon in exchange for taking away sanctions and having access to funds that Iran had frozen. The significance of this weekend is that it's the points that were needed to be implemented for everything to move forward have been reached. So Iran has done everything it was supposed to do. It has reduced the amount of highly enriched uranium it had. It has reduced the number of centrifuges by two-thirds, and it ended up pouring concrete into the reactor of its plutonium nuclear reactor in the city of Iraq, taking that out. So now it has no pathways to a nuclear weapon and has implemented a very stringent ways that we can monitor and verify that it can't get a nuclear weapon. And that happened this weekend, and that has made not only Americans but the rest of the world safer and just shows how diplomacy can work rather than military intervention.
Well, and of course now we can celebrate the release of the sailors that were captured, as well as four other detainees in Iran. So it seems as though it's just a win-win-win all around, Paul.
Well, and this shows that the relationships forged between the foreign minister of Iran and Secretary Kerry is what's helped, you know, negotiate some of these other things, such as when somehow our sailors got into the wrong parts of the ocean and were detained by Iranians. That was able to be solved peacefully and quickly within 24 hours rather than some big blow-up if we didn't have open line of communications. So we're also hoping that this deal is going to move towards normalized relations where we can start working on the other issues with Iran that we have, such as their funding of questionable organizations and terrorism and other things, and we can start working more closely with them. And that's what you want to see, because obviously that's going to lower tensions in the Middle East rather than increase them.
Paul, the conservatives criticized President Obama when he announced the Iran deal that sanctions would be lifted in return for a truly verifiable examination of the Iran nuclear capabilities. And the criticism was, well, we should have included a requirement or a condition that the Washington Post journalist Jason Rezaian, who had been living in Iran before he was taken prisoner, would be released as well. He was released. He's been freed now. Is it fair to conclude that this probably was part of the negotiations to lift the sanctions, but that was not announced until, obviously, the release was not announced until it actually happened?
I don't think that they were specifically connected, but they're connected in a way because of open communication. It has enabled open dialogue on other issues, and so we're seeing some solutions to other issues, such as the prisoner swap that happened, releasing several U.S. prisoners for some Iranian prisoners, and then the release, the quick release of American sailors. So those solutions came about because we had forged this agreement and because relationships were built between Iranian and American diplomats. And so, again, diplomacy is the way to go. And if we want to win other routes, it might not have worked out the same way.
We're talking to Paul Kawika-Martin from Peace Action Network, Peace Action, peace-action.org. And we always love to talk to Paul. Paul, Secretary of State, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who is, we all know, running for president, is taking credit for the deal. And she has said recently that, and she seems like she wants it. Tell me if I'm describing this incorrectly. Seems like she wants it both ways. She wants to be a hawk who made peace. Her statement at the primary forum on November 6th of last year was, "I spent 18 months putting together sanctions against Iran so that we could force them to the negotiating table." So, on the one hand, she's saying, yeah, we negotiated, I negotiated, but it was through force, it was through intimidation, it was through the sanctions. How accurate is that statement? And am I right that she's trying to have it both ways?
It sort of seems that way. She certainly wants to look tough on one hand, or the ability to solve problems on the other, You know, no one's been elected for being, for being too tough on Iran. So it's kind of an easy political swing. It's going to take history to find out how much sanctions actually had to do with the deal, but really it had to do with two new administrations, one on the U.S. side and one on the Iranian side. That is really the clear reason why this deal went through. We had an administration here with the Obama administration who was willing to reach out, and yes, obviously Secretary Clinton was part of that. And on the other hand, we had a new president and regime in Iran. All of those players in Iran had been people who wanted to reach out and try to work better with the West even before sanctions. So it's difficult to argue necessarily that sanctions is what made the deal happen or brought the Iranians to the table. Only history is going to show whether that's true or not. And then, you know, at the same time, we have the success. But now Hillary is saying she would like more sanctions on Iran, where you see, Senator Sanders, on the other hand, saying we should be working towards normalization. And there's clearly two different kinds of paths, more demonizing of the Iranians versus more let's work together and figure out a path forward that's going to be a win-win for both countries.
All right. Policy and political director of Peace Action, Paul Kawika Martin, is with us. Peace-action.org. They're just a great organization, and really promoting again the vision of Dr. King, peace, conversation, talk, respecting each other, trying to get to a situation where everyone's okay and nobody's killed. And that is what happened with the announcement that sanctions were being lifted in Iran. And, you know, speaking of people not being killed, people not being impoverished, Paul, what is this deal going to mean for the average Iranian? My understanding is the sanctions really imposed a lot of pain, a lot of hardship on a lot of Iranians. Is that accurate, and will this alleviate some of their suffering?
Yeah, it certainly would. This is why, in general, we oppose sanctions, because usually it really affects people that have nothing to do with the decision-making process. If you look historically, sanctions really haven't worked. Now, we're starting to get better because of technology and the ability to have very targeted sanctions on specific individuals, and that's certainly a better route to go. But broad sanctions typically is just going to affect, you know, the poorest and the weakest of a country, and not necessarily those who are in leadership. So these sanctions did affect some of the economy in Iran, some access to health, various health technologies, and even drugs, even like the safety of their airlines, because they were not able to necessarily get parts for airplanes. So one of the first things that you've seen that Iran has announced it's going to do with some of the sanctions lifting is they're going to be buying 120 new airplanes. Obviously this opening up for the economy is not only going to help the average Iranian, but it's going to help the Middle East, you know, bringing up the economy in the Middle East, bringing people out of poverty, those type of things, or helps solve various possibilities of fomenting extremism.
All right, you talked about the need to go from Iran and the negotiations there to Syria and also North Korea. Are you comfortable so far, Paul Kawika Martin from Peace Action, with the way the Obama administration has tried to deal with the situation in Syria, and not just Syria, ISIS, ISIL, the Islamic State in Syria, in Iraq? Do you think President Obama has done the utmost to avoid some type of military response? And can we avoid a military response?
Well, we do have troops and trainers on the ground. We have done airstrikes. The Obama administration has done some. I would give it maybe 20 or 30% of what it's done as being good. And a lot of stuff not being so good. providing more weapons in the region, which it has done. It's really just like pouring fuel on the fire. But it has also been leading and pushing for political talks. And these talks are now continuing, and we need to continue those efforts to move toward the ceasefire to solve the civil war in Syria. Historically, it's only through political dialogue that these types of things are going to be solved. And then, you know, the longer-term solutions of figuring out how do you lift people out of poverty in the area, how do you provide people the feeling of freedom and the feeling of control of their own destiny. Those are the things that stops people from moving towards extremism, to moving towards being a terrorist. And you can't do that by dropping bombs or providing weapons. You can only do that by investing in diplomacy, investing in development.
All right, with respect to ISIS, Hillary Clinton told Politico back in November of last year, an air campaign is necessary but not sufficient. She said we also need airstrikes combined with ground forces actually taking back more territory from ISIS. She said local people, nations have to secure their own communities. We can help them, and we should, but we cannot substitute for them. Sanders also has talked about leaving this responsibility to the local countries to take back territory from ISIS. Where Sanders and Obama most clearly differ from Clinton is she has indicated that we need regime change in Syria, whereas Obama, who supports that, says it should be decoupled from any action against ISIS. And Sanders seems the least supportive of regime change. Who do you think's got the best argument? I note Rand Paul seems to, on the Republican side, feel that this is not our fight at all. We should stay out of it. And in the past, Donald Trump has said the same.
Well, you know, we are supposed to support sovereignty of nations. And whether or not we like leaders or not, that's one thing. I certainly don't like Assad. Assad is done horrible things, but it's up to the Syrians to decide who is going to lead their country. And so what we need to move towards is some sort of way that they can have a free and fair election. And that's not going to happen in the middle of a civil war. So there needs to be a ceasefire, there needs to be some stability, then there needs to be free and fair elections for them to decide their own destiny and for them to decide who they want to lead their country. It's not going to be done at the end of a bayonet, as they would say. It's going to be done at the ballot box.
All right, Paul Kawika Martin, and let me just play this clip. I hope I get it at the right spot. This is Ted Cruz yesterday on Fox with Chris Wallace, and I'd like to get your reaction. It's pretty frightening stuff from the Texas senator. Let's
see if we can get this. I have a president who will make clear we will utterly destroy ISIS. We will carpet bomb them into oblivion.
But what's your reaction to that, Paul?
Well, I mean, the term carpet bombing come from World War II and times where we had very limited technologies, and so we'd use these campaigns that would actually kill a very high percentage of innocent people and civilians. And that is actually what's shown to drive up the numbers of not only fundraising for ISIS, but foreign fighters coming in, is when you start either killing civilians or destroying civilian territory and civilian assets. And so, sure, let's go ahead and carpet bomb, and basically you're going to be doing the exact opposite. So you might, for every four or five ISIS people you kill, you're going to create another 50 because of public opinion. It is a ridiculous way to try to deal with this issue. There's a number of other ways without military force to deal with ISIS, which includes, freezing their assets, going after their money and resources. They're selling antiquities that they're getting. We need to go after the antiquity market, after the sex trade. Also trying to restrict the foreign fighters that are going into. There's a number of ways that we can squeeze them of their resources, and then do the longer term things, which is going to create an atmosphere where people are less likely to support ISIS. And that's the way that they're going to slowly die out. It's not going to be by bombing them, for sure.
All right, before we move to North Korea, on the same topic, bombing, again, back to the Democratic front runner, Hillary Clinton. She's talking about, she says the way to smash the would-be caliphate is with a more effective coalition air campaign, more allied planes, more strikes, and a broader target set. I'll be honest with you, I don't hear a huge difference. I don't see that much light between Clinton and Cruz. Am I wrong? Am I missing something here, Paul?
Well, I mean, there's certainly differences in language. You know, if you have targets and carpet bombing are definitely two different types of a military strike. And in any case, it's just like this is not going to be solved via military. It's at the end of the day. Certainly some military stuff is going to help, but it's going to be local policing, local diplomacy, starving of resources, other methods that are going to take care of solving the ISIS issue. It's not going to be by bombing them. So that's just, again, it's fuel on the fire.
All right. You also talk about, in your announcement, lauding the agreement with Iran. At Peace Action, you talk about a similar diplomatic effort with North Korea. Now, when you talk about a diplomatic effort with Assad, it seems very, very reasonable. But aren't ISIS and North Korea entities that seem resistant to any kind of blandishments, any type of diplomatic efforts? As you mentioned, Iran with a much more moderate president now, President Rouhani, who has, you know, really put some distance between himself and the most conservative elements of the nation. Is there that kind of opportunity with North Korea?
I think so. I mean, you know, certainly ISIS and North Korea are two very different animals. But North Korea had been involved in six-party talks for a number of years, and there were various freezing of their nuclear program in exchange for monies and things that were moving forward. But they did collapse, but they need to start again. One of the things we learned with Iran is when we went with into the negotiations with Iran, we did them without any preconditions. We didn't say that Iran had to agree to such, such, and such before we even went into the negotiations. That's how negotiations fail right off the bat. No one's going to come to the table if you tell them that agree to certain things before you even have a negotiation talk. And right now, that's what the U.S. is doing with North Korea. They're saying before six-party talks resumes, North Korea has to come and say it's going to freeze its nuclear program. It's going to take a number of steps before even coming to the table. That's just not the way it's going to work. So we need to get back into the six-party talks, which the six parties are the key parties in the region. And China had recently, in the last couple months, has said that that they are willing to, that North Koreans are willing to, and it's the U.S. that's blocking our path forward. And so I think it's very important that we move back to getting to the table without preconditions so we can negotiate with North Korea and try to put a halt to their nuclear weapons program.
All right, just a couple more minutes left with Paul. We can't keep him past the bottom of the hour. Paul, is North Korea a threat, though, that we should even be putting in the same conversation with Iran or ISIS Syria?
I think both North Korea and Iran are really not a huge threat. I mean, they're not a threat at all to normal U.S. citizens here. Iran certainly does meddle in the Middle East. Like everyone in the Middle East meddles with each other. Those are issues of certain concern. North Korea, they are continuing to better their missile technology. I mean, I have no, there's no concern that they would actually do some sort of a nuclear weapon strike, but you open up the possibility of either accidents or someone stealing a nuclear weapon or some horrible thing like that, that's something that we don't want to have. So less nuclear weapons in the world is certainly going to make us safer than more, and there's certainly less nuclear weapons in the hands of people who may not be a part of the international community is a wise idea. So, yes, we should be talking with North Korea, and we also need to think about the North Korean people who are not in control of their destiny, have issues of starvation, and so if we can get in there and assist and kind of move that country towards coming back into the international fray, I think that will make that region more stable and secure.
All right, that's a great way to end the conversation with Paul Kawika Martin on this Dr. Martin Luther King Day. Thank you so much, Paul. We'll be back after this.
This is Scientific American's 60-Second Science. I'm Steve Mirsky. Got a minute? The word Siberia is almost a synonym for extreme cold. It's hard enough to imagine living there today, but humans have been wandering the icy terrain for thousands of years. The accepted estimate for the arrival of the first humans north of the Arctic Circle was upped in 2004 from about 12,000 years ago to 35,000 years ago. And now that number's been revised again, because in 2012, a young boy some 1,250 miles south of the North Pole in Siberia stumbled across the leg bones of a woolly mammoth protruding out of the ground.
What really made this a super important find were two things.
Ann Gibbons, contributing correspondent for the journal Science, which published an analysis of the frozen mammoth, talking about the finding on the Science podcast.
One, it had a lot of injuries that show it had been battered and shot with projectile points by humans. And then the second part that was really exciting was that when they used radiocarbon dating, it dated to about 45,000 years of age. So this was at least 10,000 years older than the earliest presence of humans in the Arctic Circle before.
People may have gone so far north because of the mammoths.
This is a huge, vast steppe region full of mammoths and large woolly rhinoceroses and reindeer and elk. So if humans could figure out how to live in the cold up north, they were lucky and would have a great source, a great packet of meat to get when they needed it.
You can hear the entire episode of the Science Podcast with Ann Gibbons talking about the mammoth find at www.science.com. Thanks for the minute. For Scientific American's 60-Second Science, I'm Steve Mirsky.
All right. Thank you so much to Paul Kawika Martin from Peace Action. Peace-action.org is the website. I call them Peace Action Network. I think they once were called Peace Action Network, but now they've gone just to Peace Action. They've dropped the network, so that's what I call them, Peace Action, Peace-action. And that conversation is part of today's show. I don't know, do I call it a podcast? I guess I could. We won't have the entire show up because I didn't start recording till the bottom of the hour. But all of Paul's interview will be on the website at halginsberg.com, and I think it's going to be about a half hour, and I'll let you know when I put the link there in the archive section, halginsberg.com. And now they don't want to play my little clip here because I stupidly changed somehow the associated application that plays a particular program. So instead of the free one that I've got up there, MPlayer, it was going to go to a paid one, which I have not paid for because I try to avoid paying for anything if I can. And my ding is now no longer associated with the correct sound file. So let's see if I can get the ding back to what it should be, which is, I guess, the media. Really? Well, let's see if we can do it this way. There we go. So it is working. HalGinsberg.com. Let's see if it works this time. No, it does not want to work that time. I'll figure that out, folks. I promise you. I will figure it out. I talked about football. I promise also I will get to the debate yesterday. That's a big deal, right? I mean, that's what matters. And by the way, the Republican debate as well. if we can. I don't want to play from the Republican debate. That was on Thursday. I did talk about it a little bit, but I do want to play a clip of Pat Buchanan talking about the Republican debate, which I think is kind of important, actually. If we get a chance, I will get to that. But I mentioned, one other thing I did mention was football, and I've told you, I guess I don't know, am I a hypocrite? Am I a liar? What would you call me? I'm not sure. It's hard for me to move away. I mean, I do love watching the games. They're very exciting. They're fun to watch, although obviously for the players, they're incredibly painful as well. And I can't stand that. I hate to see the injuries. But it's hard for me to turn away. Had a couple friends came over, which was nice. We all watched the game together with my kids, my wife. We watched the game Sunday night. So that was the Broncos game. And I wanted Pittsburgh to win. I'm not a huge Pittsburgh fan, but I definitely was preferring Pittsburgh to Denver, maybe in part because I think it's going to be it would have been easier. Pittsburgh lost, although they had a good chance. I think they should have won. They played better. They had I think it would be better for the Patriots if they played in New England next week against Pittsburgh than having to go to Denver. But it's going to be exciting, Manning versus Brady, however many times they played each other one more time. That is going to be exciting. Mike Tomlin is the coach of the Pittsburgh Steelers, and I heard him say this on another station this morning, I think, and I was so taken by it I wanted to play it for you. I thought this was just really interesting use of language by the Pittsburgh Steelers head coach, who is one of the top probably five coaches in the NFL, and he showed a lot of class. He had to be heartbroken. Looked like he had the game won. The Steelers were ahead. They were driving in the fourth quarter, and one of his players dropped the ball. It was a fumble. The Broncos recovered it and promptly scored a touchdown that put them ahead, a lead they did not relinquish. Here is Mike Tomlin on the loss right after the game last night.
We fought hard, just not enough today. Came up a few plays short, such is life. I just appreciate the efforts of our football team. There can only be one, obviously, and this year is not us. And we'll absorb that. Obviously, we'll take responsibility for us not being that team. But I really appreciate the efforts. I've been doing this 9 years, man. It's only been 1 year where the conversation ended in the manner in which you want it to end. So such is life in this business. It's not easy, but we're built for it. It's just how it goes.
Yeah, I just thought that was a fascinating line when he said, I've been in this business for 9 years. I've been a head coach for 9 years. That's pretty long. I mean, you don't get to be a head coach for 9 years unless you're pretty darn good. And he said, and only one of those years did the conversation end the way we wanted it to, or the way you want it to end. I thought that was a really interesting way to describe sports, to describe the NFL. It's a conversation. It's a dialogue. And only 1 year, the year that they won the Super Bowl, that the Steelers won, would he say that was the way he wanted or they wanted the conversation to end. I also, again, on coaches, I mean, maybe he doesn't deserve, I don't know how much credit you give Tomlin, but obviously his heart was broken. He was very, very disappointed. His backup running back, Fitzgerald Toussaint, dropped the ball, and he was asked about that, and you could hear he would not criticize his player. And that's, that's being a good coach. That's being a class act. So, I'm sorry for Tomlin, because I really did want to see the Steelers make it to the championship. Although, again, seeing Manning versus Brady yet again has its attraction as well. I told you we'll get back to politics in just a moment, the Democratic debate last night. The phone number here, by the way, if you want to join me on this Dr. King Day, 844-4-HELL-G, 844-367-4254. A poll came out yesterday that really took a lot of wind out of my sails. I haven't seen it written up, discussed on the internet much, but the NBC News Wall Street Journal poll showed Clinton up 25 points nationally. And this certainly is against the trend we've been seeing, which is move towards Sanders. Certainly in the two first states, the DMR poll showed Clinton up by only two in Iowa. Des Moines Register poll, although, again, another poll in Iowa, Gravis, had Clinton up by 21. That had come out the day before, but was apparently more recent in terms of the polling. And I mentioned to you, I thought Clinton's lies about health care, her fear-mongering, the scare that she and Chelsea are trying to throw into the electorate, that Sanders would take away their Affordable Care Act plans. I said, I think those scare tactics are working. I am afraid they will work. And I say to my fellow Americans, we must avoid, as Dr. King says, the tranquilizing drug of gradualism. The Affordable Care Act is not enough. Clinton's call to improve it is the tranquilizing drug of gradualism. We must not be satisfied with this gradualist approach when we can and should and have every right to demand universal single-payer coverage, as Sanders is calling for. And we most especially must reject the call when it's based on lies, dishonesty, that somehow it will be more expensive to cover every American, that somehow it will come out of our pockets rather than leave us actually better off financially. And yet I fear from looking at the Facebook pages of the Clinton supporters who parrot, who repeat this lie, who are spreading fear, uncertainty, and doubt, who are disseminating Republican talking points about single-payer coverage, who are carrying water for the healthcare corporations that profit from the Affordable Care Act, that puts more money in their pockets rather than universal single-payer coverage, which would allow us, the people, to negotiate with the corporations and demand that they provide services and product at a fair price, not at a monopolist price. We must demand more than Hillary Clinton is rather, I think, grudgingly willing to offer us. But I'm afraid the fear, the uncertainty and doubt that she and the hitman from Media Matters there, David Brock, are prepared to parse out to us, to dole out. We must demand more. I fear we will not get it. One interesting takeaway from that NBC Wall Street Journal poll, despite the fact that Clinton bests Sanders by 25 points, according to it, which came out yesterday, Sanders does better against Trump. It's kind of odd. It's the exact same poll. So even though Clinton crushes Sanders, I mean, 59-34 is a drubbing. You would think, how could she possibly do worse than Sanders against Trump? But she does. Sanders beats Trump by 15 points in that NBC News Wall Street Journal poll, whereas Clinton beats Trump by 10. So if your concern is electability, again, you got to go with Clinton. I mean, I want to cut out my tongue right now. I want, please, someone shoot me in the head. If your concern is electing a Democrat, if you say, well, listen, I actually like Sanders better. I think he's right on health care. I think he's right when it comes to jobs. Let's bring him back to America. But I think, I want to make sure we elect, we choose on the Democratic side the most electable candidate. Well, then Sanders is your guy. Sanders, yet again, in yet one more poll, does better than Clinton against a Republican. And in every poll, he does better against the Republican than Clinton. Kind of weird, because NBC Wall Street Journal Marist did a poll that came out on the 10th, and they did another poll that came out on the 17th. It's kind of weird. I do think this move towards Clinton is driven by her scare tactics, and I just hope that people get it, that they read the PolitiFact that says it's not true, that Sanders' plan will cost more money. I hope they get that his plan will result in a savings for all but the richest Americans. Because this is, you know, this is the whole enchilada. We finally have a chance, folks, to elect a true progressive. We finally have a chance to elect somebody who truly feels in his bones the immortal words of Dr. King. Let's not blow it. Please, I implore you. Please, let's not blow it.
See, is the difference between what you would do about the banks and what Secretary Clinton would do.
The first difference is I don't take money from big banks. I don't get personal speaking fees from Goldman Sachs. What I would do is understand that when you have three out of the four largest banks today bigger than they were when we bailed them out because they were too big to fail, when you have the six largest financial institutions having assets of 60% of the GDP of America, it is very clear to me what you have to do. You got to bring back a 21st century Glass-Steagall legislation, and you got to break up these huge financial institutions. They have too much economic power, and they have too much financial power over our entire economy. If Teddy Roosevelt were alive today, the old Republican trustbuster, what he would say is, these guys are too powerful, break them up. I believe that's what the American people want to see. That's my view.
Secretary Clinton, help the voter understand the daylight between the two of you here.
Well, there's no daylight on the basic premise that there should be no bank too big to fail and no individual too powerful to jail. We agree on that. But where we disagree is the comments that Senator Sanders has made that don't just affect me, I can take that. But he's criticized President Obama.
She's just disgusting. This is the most disgusting thing I've ever heard, where she just completely deflects his point. Hey, you're in the pocket of the one percenters. You're in the pocket of the giant banks. Oh, well, I can take it. But he's attacking President Obama. This is such a coded language to African Americans. This is playing the race card writ large. Oh, he's going after our African American president. And it's ugly. It's wrong. You've got to send a message to her and to the fixer, Lanny Davis, and to the hitman, David Brock, who's behind this scurrilousness, that this is not allowed.
And President Obama has led our country out of the Great Recession. Senator Sanders called him weak, disappointing. He even in 2011 publicly sought someone to run in a primary against President Obama. Now, I personally believe that President Obama's work to push through the Dodd-Frank bill and then to sign it was one of the most important regulatory schemes we've had since the 1930s. So I'm going to defend Dodd-Frank, and I'm going to defend President Obama for taking on Wall Street, taking on the financial industry.
You're having a spotted owl on whites only. Come on, baby. Raise my interest rate. Bust my union. Light my library fire.
She only deals in quality narcotics and guns. Got a Mexican wallet made from real Mexicans. My conservative girl.
Right, that's who you're going to elect. You vote for Clinton, that's who you're getting. Better than the alternative, the lesser of two evils, I'll grant you all of that. But we got a real hero. We can elect somebody who really is our, takes no money from the banks, no money from the healthcare industry, no money from the private prison industry. My gosh, please, please, America, don't blow it. Don't, 25% of us are poor. 1% have 42% of everything. Don't blow it. I implore you, don't blow it.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. West Virginia's state legislature is taking another run at passing an anti-union so-called right-to-work law The Teamsters are joining other unions there in opposition. A rally this week at the State House when the legislation was introduced drew hundreds of workers. Teamsters General Secretary Treasurer Ken Hall says for years, out-of-state corporate interests have made billions of dollars on the backs of hardworking West Virginia families. He says now they're attacking the one thing that protected workers in the state, union contracts. Anti-union politicians in West Virginia tried and failed to pass this anti-union legislation in 2015. It died then in committee as thousands of workers rallied at the state capitol. Clergy and laity united for economic justice Thursday called on the management of Alliance College Ready Charter Schools in Los Angeles to stop their anti-union actions against teachers. Gracia Lopez Reyes is an organizer with the faith group.
We wrote a faith letter that has been signed by about 50 faith leaders supporting the teachers and calling on the Alliance to stop their anti-union campaign against the teachers, to stop their retaliation, intimidation, and coercion against the educators.
Lopez Reyes says that these tactics are creating problems in the communities served by the charter schools in Los Angeles, and some of the tactics trying to intimidate pro-union teachers are illegal.
It's separating the teachers and the parents. It's creating a lot of tension, not allowing them to meet in the property during non-work time, you know, not even use their emails. The LA Superior Court already filed a temporary restraining order against Alliance for their anti-union campaign because they have violated the law. And so we as a faith community cannot stand, you know, with that. We need to support our educators.
Iconic American firearms manufacturer Colt has emerged from bankruptcy with its union contract intact. UAW Local 376 members are relieved that the union contract was not a bankruptcy casualty. The UAW worked closely with management at Colt to keep the company going through the bankruptcy. The UAW contract continued without operation. The UAW contract continued without interruption throughout the bankruptcy case. The UAW made modifications in retiree health care, but otherwise, the contract made it through intact.
Workers Independent News is proud to be heard on The Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio. Live nationwide weekdays, noon to 3 p.m. at theunionedge.com.
WIN is made possible in part by the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned, union-represented Bank of Labor. Bank of Labor has provided trust and fiduciary services to labor organizations for nearly a century. Online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
All right, phone number. Am I on? Why don't I hear myself? I should be. I see the levels moving. All right, if you want to join me, 844-367. There I go. 844-367-4254. 844-4-HELL-G. Did you watch that debate? I didn't watch it. I didn't. I mean, I listened to Bill Press going over it, and I found some clips for you, but I didn't watch. Look, I don't watch these things. I already know who I'm going to vote for. It's not going to change my opinion. It's not going to change. They have decades of in the public eye. They have decades of votes and speeches and rhetoric and history. So you try to spin yourself a little bit. That's not going to change anything for me. But I admit it makes a difference for the electorate. It really does. So if you did watch it, I want to know, who do you think won? If you watched that debate, 844-4-HELL-G, 844-367-4254, who won that debate? I'm at the New York Times page. Who won the day? They have the question. Who won the Democrat debate? Viewers lean towards Bernie Sanders. That's good. I don't know how they got that. What that's from, was that some sort of a poll they did? It says just viewers lean towards Bernie, and I'd have no idea why they say that. According to various commentators across the web, this is what the Times says, many commentators from across the web thought that a more aggressive Sanders gave himself a boost by taking Clinton on more forcefully. She scored points on a shifting positions on guns and taxes, but was not seen as dealing any decisive blows. Martin O'Malley, meanwhile, was most notable for his unsuccessful attempts or efforts to get a word in. Frank Luntz says Bernie needed an overwhelming victory, and at best he got a narrow one. That won't be enough to win the Dem nomination, I fear. I didn't watch it, but I don't know how he... She's got, you know, the endorsements. I guess they matter. I don't know why. I mean, why do you care if a well-connected politico, if a congresswoman who is reliant upon the support of the president, who's reliant upon Hillary Clinton's fundraising, when you know the vindictiveness of the Clintons, why do you care if some congresswoman says she supports Hillary Clinton? I know there are some truly, there are statesmen and stateswomen in Congress. John Lewis, the great civil rights leader, the hero from Georgia, he endorsed Clinton. And I got a real problem with that. I don't get it. You shouldn't have done that. I mean, I can't understand it. I'm very, very disheartened by that. I truly am. I just do not see how he can view her as the legitimate heir to Dr. King. That was something that I find very upsetting. But I do have great respect for John Lewis. And I'm sorry that I think he made a mistake here. I can't explain it. I'm certainly not going to criticize him for it. I think he is a man of great integrity. And if he believes, if he says that he wants Hillary Clinton to be the next president, I think it means he believes she's the right candidate. In this case, with all due respect, and that respect is very great for John Lewis, you're wrong. I don't believe you're right. I believe you're wrong, sir. Hillary Clinton is not the right candidate. She is not the heir to Dr. King's message of equality, of economic justice, of peace. The candidate who says we need more strikes, more planes against the people in the Middle East who live in the region that includes eastern Syria, western Iraq, below Turkey. More planes, more strikes. She is not the heir to Dr. King. The candidate who fearmongers universal single-payer coverage is not the heir to Dr. King, with all due respect, Congressman Lewis. The candidate who invokes President Obama to avoid answering questions about the millions, the tens of millions of dollars that she has raked in from Wall Street, from giant corporations, who invokes President Obama to avoid discussing the hundreds of thousands of dollars she takes at one clip from our state universities. That candidate is not the heir to Dr. King. Support Bernie Sanders. He's the right candidate. I heard this clip on the Progressive Network, the Progressive Voices Network. Tara Devlin is her name. You may have heard it. I thought it was so powerful, I really wanted to play it again, because you probably will hear it, but I thought this was very, very effective indeed. She says this better than I do. So here's Tara Devlin on the Democratic primaries.
This is Tara Devlin, a.k.a. Taradactyl, from RepublicanDirtyTricks.com on the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn. And this is my two-minute tirade.
As the saying goes, nothing in politics happens by accident. That blip from 1947 to 1980 where the American working class became the American middle class was a result of FDR's New Deal policies that set the ground rules for shared prosperity. We now have unlimited legal bribery in politics and the unabashed courting of billionaires. This is not the dream of democracy that came from the liberal age of enlightenment that so many fought, bled, and died to create. Government isn't broken, it's fixed. For those at the top, we have woken up on the wrong side of Reaganomics, and the middle class is now less than 50% of the population. Be alarmed, because like Justice Louis Brandeis said, we can have democracy or concentrated wealth, but not both. But for the first time in generations, we have a shot at being able to do more than just pantomime democracy in the hope that some Wall Street-funded Washington flunky will be kind enough to talk about throwing us a screw. wrap. We actually have a shot of choosing a candidate who hasn't taken a dime from Wall Street, who doesn't believe in bribes from big business or endless war or bankster profiteering in all its many unconscionable forms. Let me be clear, this is me talking, not the station, and I'm asking you to join us in the fight to rebuild democracy in the new progressive era, along with our standard bearer, Bernie Sanders. We can't just throw a band-aid over the bleeding artery of income inequality. Get out there and vote in the primary. It's time for a true political revolution. This is Tara Devlin from RepublicanDirtyTricks.com. Go there and find links to my Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram communities, and keep listening for 2-Minute Tirades and more on the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn. We stick together, we win.
Yeah, now, very powerful the top of the from Tara Devlin there, Pterodactyl. Very well played by her. All right, 844-4-HELGY if you want to join me. 844-367-4254. I'll tell you what, let's hit our last top of the hour break, or second last would imply there's like at least three. There's two, because there's one after the first hour, and there's one after the second, and then the show's over after the third. So if you want to join me in that third hour, I'd love to talk to you. If you watch the Democratic debate, what's your sense? What's your sense of the race right now? The New York Times says Bernie won on points. Was that what you thought? Is that going to be enough? 844-4-HELGY, 844-367-4254.
Young people speak in their minds, are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
It's Tuesday, January 12, 2016.
This was the literal thing we had to do to put ourselves in front of a train to say, we will not take this anymore.
Oil train protesters use necessity defense in oil train blockade.
These new rates have made it impossible for us to operate as a business here.
Huge setback for solar in Nevada. Extreme weather is extremely expensive. 2015 broke the record for the most expensive wildfires. Plus, another one bites the dust. Another big coal company goes bankrupt.
All of those stories and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
For those of you who don't habla español, El Niño is Spanish for... the Nino.
This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, you always bring amazing stories, but today there's one in particular out of Nevada. Don't know if that's your first one, but it kind of blows my mind.
Yep, in Nevada, the solar industry is leaving Las Vegas and the entire state.
We were heartbroken that they made this choice to just rip the rug out from under thousands of customers, thousands of employees. These new rates have made it impossible for us to operate as a business here.
That was a regional manager of industry leader Solar City after the Nevada Public Utilities Commission approved a recent request by Nevada's monopoly electric utility, NV Energy, to gut the state's solar net metering program. That pays rooftop solar owners for electricity that they deliver back to the grid. NV Energy also now gets to charge hefty new monthly fees to both new and existing customers. Solar City and other major residential rooftop solar companies have now left Nevada, laying off thousands of workers.
It was a somber, frustrating day as Solar City's crew tore down the same structure where they learned how to install solar panels.
Our existing customers are no longer saving money. They're actually paying more than they would if they didn't have solar. So it's prevented us from being able to operate to sales and installations here in Nevada.
So this is an amazing story to me. These are people who put solar panels on their roof. They were promised a cut in electricity rates since sunshine is free.
That's right, and it's happening from monopoly utilities all over the country.
This is absolutely remarkable. I don't see how it stands, but I guess for now, people in Nevada, where there is nothing but sun falling from the sky, by the way, they're just completely out of luck. This is amazing.
That's right. In Washington State, the criminal trial begins this week for the Delta Five, five members of the climate action group Rising Tide Seattle, who locked themselves to railroad tracks in 2014 to block explosive oil trains from going through their county. For the first time ever, the presiding judge in the case will allow the Delta Five to use what's called the necessity defense, arguing that their blockade was necessary and justified because of the threat of climate change. That's according to climate activist Tim DeChristopher on Democracy Now!, who himself served time in federal prison for his own civil disobedience action that blocked oil drilling on public lands.
This is the first time that defendants who have taken civil disobedience action will be able to present a full defense, including climate scientists and oil train explosion experts, as well as sharing all their own testimony about why they were driven to take this action.
Meanwhile, extreme weather is extremely expensive. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration announced that 2015 saw 10 extreme weather events that caused at least $1 billion or more in damage in the U.S. There were only $8 billion weather disasters in 2014. The $10 billion or more disasters in 2015 included drought, floods, wildfires, and extreme winter and spring storms. The record was 16 events in 2011. 2015 was also the biggest and most expensive wildfire season in U.S. history. The U.S. Forest Service announced that wildfires last year burned a record 10 million acres, and for the first time, they had to use more than half of their budget on firefighting, forced to siphon funds away from fire prevention programs to pay the rising costs. The agency has requested Congress to increase their budget and designate wildfires as natural disasters like hurricanes and floods, but so far to no avail. Finally, another one bites the dust. Arch Coal, the nation's second largest coal mining company, filed for bankruptcy on Monday, the latest in a string of high-profile coal industry bankruptcies in the U.S. U.S. coal production has fallen to its lowest levels since the mid-80s, thanks in part to new pollution standards, but mostly due to the glut of cheaper, cleaner-burning natural gas and lack of demand from China. Arch Coal's stock price crashed from $260 a share in 2011 to now less than a dollar.
Yeah, well, it ain't over yet. If we have to take off all the solar panels, we may need that coal. Man, for much more on all of the stories we covered today and the ones we couldn't get to, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find us and follow us on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Yeah. Another one bites the dust. Another one bites the dust. And another one gone. And another one gone. Another
one bites the dust. To stop it must be ours.
And don't let anybody make you think that God chose America as his divine messianic force to be a sort of policeman of the whole world. God has a way of standing before the nations with judgment, and it seems that I can hear God saying to America, you are too arrogant. If you don't change your ways, I will rise up and break the backbone of your power. And I'll place it in the hands of a nation that doesn't even know my name. Be still and know that I'm God. The promises of the great society have been shot down on the battlefield of Vietnam, making the poor, white and Negro, bear the heaviest burdens both at the front and at home. Other civil rights leaders, for various reasons, refuse or can't take a stand or have to go along with the administration. That's their business. But I'm a say tonight.
All right, I want to stop it. Just such a great person. When you're talking about, you know, the rarefied air, the greatest of all time, greatest people of all time, he's right there. I mean, who else, right, do you put in that short list with Dr. King? I mean, people who make you free, who make people freer, who make people's lives better. I don't think there's many people that are up there with King. I mean, you have to go a long way. You have to go a long distance in years and in geography to find people who are on his level. And when you hear him speaking about war, I mean, let me just a couple of points, a couple little clips there, snippets that made him so great. He talks about who bears the brunt, the price of the war, the poor. He universalizes the message. It's the poor who suffer, not just the Negro, not just, that's his term, not just the white, the poor. And he says, hey, some people don't want to go after the president, Lyndon Baines Johnson, because after all, he did sign the civil rights law, and he did exercise and you know, use his very, very considerable political skills, his talents, his persuasiveness to get Congress to pass the civil rights bills. But I can't let that cloud my judgment. I can't let that stop me, says Dr. King, from criticizing what I know is wrong, and that is the war in Vietnam. And I'll contrast that. Contrast that with the you scratch my back, the quid pro quo that so many of today's politicians, so many of today's leaders engage in. This is a very, very great man that we celebrate today, Dr. King. His birthday, by the way, I looked it up, January 15. I didn't have it off the tip of my tongue. If we want, if we're serious about continuing his legacy, I do not see an option but to vote for, to work for, to campaign on behalf of Bernie Sanders.
Secretary Clinton didn't answer your question. Because what her campaign was saying, Bernie Sanders, who has fought for universal health care for my entire life, he wants to end Medicare, end Medicaid, end the Children's Health Insurance Program. That is nonsense. What a Medicare for All program does is finally provide in this country health care for every man, woman, and child as a right. We are paying the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs, getting ripped off. And here's the important point. We are spending far more per person on health care than the people of any other country. My proposal, provide health care to all people, get private insurance, out of health insurance, lower the cost of health care for middle-class families by $5,000. That's the vision we need to take.
All right, just so spot on. How can we turn our back on him because the opponent claims falsely, because she lies, because she says, oh, he's gonna raise your taxes. He wants to take away your Medicare. He wants to take away your Medicaid. He wants to take away your CHIP, your SCHIP. No, no, no. And we're gonna accept that? We're gonna buy that? Is that what's gonna happen? I sure hope it's not. I sure hope we're too smart for that. I'm sure hope that we can continue. You know, when Dr. King was marching on Washington, Bernie Sanders was there with him. When Dr. King was speaking against the Vietnam War, Bernie Sanders was protesting it. Bernie Sanders was desegregating dorms at the University of Chicago. Seems like a small thing, but you know what? It took guts. It was brave. He was on the right side of that issue all those years ago. What was Hillary Clinton doing? She was a Goldwater girl. She was the president of the Wellesley Republicans. Just think about it. And you know what? I would say it all didn't matter. Who cares? If she were a genuine progressive now, if she had turned her back on the corporatists, on the ruling elites, then who cares what she did 50 years ago? But we see a thread that has run through her entire career, opportunism, putting herself first, putting the corporate interest, the interest of the wealthy and powerful first, and it continues to this day. Let's go to Carl. Carl, I don't want you to miss a word of that. Good morning, Carl.
Hey, good morning. I never thought about that until this morning. Do you know who I'm for?
No. You're for the Democrat. You're for the Democrat. You said that.
No, I mean, who I would prefer. to be president. If I was emperor for
the I would never guess because you've spoken finely, you've spoken highly of both. I'll be honest with you, Carl. If you force me to guess, I'll say you're for Sanders because you've spoken more highly of Sanders than it seems to me when you speak of Clinton, you're more criticizing me for criticizing her than you are defending her. So I'm going to go with, if you force me to say who you're for, I'm going to say you're for Sanders.
Okay. I'm going to tell you this right here. I think that Hillary Clinton would be a great president. I think that Bernard Sanders would be a transformative. He would continue the work of Barack Obama and go even further. I think that he would be the best president in our country as far as that since Roosevelt. And they fear the hell out of him. The country has gone left. I mean, really, truly and honestly, the country has gone left. That's one of the reasons. People say, well, how can a democratic socialist be winning in a poll somewhere in America? How could that be? That's because the country has moved that way, and the country would make Hillary Clinton go that way and make her a great president. Bernie Sanders would be one of the most transformative presidents in our history. I'm for Bernie. I want Bernie to be the president. And the point I've been trying to make to people forever, and this is before people start jumping on the Bernie bandwagon, is that, you know what? Bernie Sanders can win. He's very electable because the country is at a totally different place that our mind will allow us to go. Think about that for a minute. As much as the Republicans have tried to confuse their dumbed-down base with isms, socialism, communism, fascism, racism, and knowing that they may not understand the difference between a socialist and a communist, they've done it very well. They're very good at that, but they're still not stopping the momentum of Bernie Sanders. That's because the country in a whole is much more aware than we even give them credit for.
I really appreciate that. I never was sure who you supported. You asked me. I gave you the best, honest answer I could, and I'm pleased to hear that, Carl. And, you know, when you call in, you make such strong and, I think, very persuasive arguments that I shouldn't be too harsh on Clinton that causes me to think maybe you're on her camp. But your arguments are good ones. I agree with you. The Republicans are, there's not even a comparison, okay? She is reasonable. She is realistic. She is reality-based. And she also will be moved by public opinion. And also, beyond that, what's best for the people. She will be moved by what's best for the people. But that said, the ties to Wall Street, the ties to the corporations, and her positions, the triangulating that continues now with the fear-mongering about the cost of the single payer, to me, that is so...
Carl. Here's the thing, and I'm going to help you with that argument. I'm going to help you ease your mind with that argument. What's lost in the argument, because I'm for single payer. I am, and I'm pretty sure you are for single payer. I'm for
absolutely
totally. I am, me personally, I probably go even further. I think it should be criminal to charge people for health care in a country this rich. No one should die or go bankrupt because they have cancer. No one should watch their child suffer because they can't afford medical care. No one should go hungry because
they got to choose between the medicine or the food.
Exactly.
I saw this movie. I'm going to interrupt you for a second. I want to say something about President Obama. I saw this movie of John Fugelsang, who's a host, a TV host, and a comedian. It was called Dream On, and they interviewed a number of people in the past year in the age of Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, And there were people who were deciding between, and they said, they just flat out said, I got to decide sometimes between food and my blood pressure medication. And of course, these people are often very heavy.
Right.
They have bad eating habits, not by their own choice, but they have no other option. And this is my other point, Carl. And just hold on one sec. Just let me get this call. Hold for one sec. I think that's Harvey. Harvey, I'll get you in a second. I don't criticize President Obama for Obamacare. I do not. I think it's a good thing. I praise him. I think that is one of his triumphs. And you've never heard me criticize him for it. In fact, I think it's amazing he got as far as he did, and I don't blame him even for the public option. Because
there was even Democrats that
that's
didn't
right.
even think
well,
that
they said,
could ever get.
Yes, in fact, that's exactly right. Max Baucus and, you know, false Democrat, no Democrat, Lieberman, basically, they said, we'll join the Republicans and filibuster your bill if you even have a public option in there. And then you'll get nothing
absolutely.
At all. Absolutely.
And then Grassley from Iowa dragged his feet along because it made seem like that he was coming along. So it was a lot of. My bigger point is this right here with the Hillary argument.
Wait, let me. Go ahead. All right, go ahead. Because I wanted to give him more praise because you don't think I praise him enough.
Okay.
I think this Iran deal is a great thing that President Obama did.
It's a great thing. We're actually talking to Iran.
Did
you get my email I sent to you?
Well, you did about the gas prices, and you know me, I want prices to go up, so
why I sent it to you.
But I don't have a problem with the commodity price.
I don't do anything, I want a tax.
I know. I want the tax to go up, but I want the commodity price to go down, so the companies get less money for their product, but we pay more for it. I know that sounds crazy, but anyway, you were talking about affordable care.
About Hillary. About Hillary's point that she's trying to make and was really lost because of people dislike for Hillary. What she is saying is that we have these Republican governors like Brownback and here in Tennessee that won't take the money that's supposed to be allocated to poor people in the state. They refuse to take it. And what would they do if left up to the states to control individual.
But it's a lie because Bernie's plan wouldn't allow the governors to decline the help.
You know what? Instead of being visceral about it, instead of calling it a lie, I like that Bernie came back with his thing.
He did.
It's called a debate. It's called a debate of issues.
Well, he said it's not true. He said it was nonsense. So I guess, other pundits have called a lie. Let me say one other positive about Obama on Obamacare is, the Republican governors refusing the Medicaid, that wasn't in the original bill. The law required them to take that money. It was only a ridiculous reach by the right wingers on the Supreme Court that gave the governors that power. And it was a terrible thing they did because it turned a lot of people against people who would have been for Obamacare. Now they're like, well, it's not doing anything for me, so it's no good.
I'm telling you, we are, the country is understanding and seeing this, and people are going to pay politically for this. Look at Louisiana. I look at Louisiana as one of my secondary home states because my mother's side of the family is from there. We spent summers in Nashville or either our summers in New Orleans, either one. And I literally have my whole mother's side of the family is from there.
Wait, why would you go to New Orleans? Would you go to New Orleans for the summer? It's pretty hot, isn't it? I
know, man, but it's still one of the greatest cities in the whole world.
Isn't that where you go for the winter? That's where I go. When do you want to go there?
We would go to a Mardi Gras, which is pretty nice during, February and everything. Right. That was pretty nice to do that. But I'm telling you, but knowing that state the way I know it, they have a Democratic governor, and immediately one of the first things he did was to take the money that Bobby Jindal refused to take. This is the movement that's going on. When you have a country that will elect a Democrat that's telling you that he is going to repeal what the other governor had done, one of their biggest talking points, keeping the money out of the state. And that particular red state in the deepest of the deep South, they elect this man. That lets you know that a guy like Bernie Sanders could be elected as president.
I think he could. I hate that argument. I hate the argument we can't elect him because that was the argument Clinton made against Obama. So I hate that argument.
You know, That is so much garbage. I watched the last week on Meet the Republicans. I mean Meet the Press. Chuck Todd saying that if Hillary loses Iowa and New Hampshire, that guys like Kerry or someone would have to come in, you know. And I'm thinking to myself, no, Bernard Sanders is right there. O'Malley is right there. These guys, I mean, they were like, basically they were saying that Senator Sanders is unelectable.
The corporate media is terrified of him. That's one more reason to support him. That's why we should support him, because people like Chuck Todd and NBC are afraid that he would take a little bit of the money that they've already grabbed and from us. And that's all.
The unelectability argument is absolutely, boy, you know what. It's crap. And what I like about our side so much is that we could have these substantive debates and base reality debates and pick and choose one of these three people on the stage, because even O'Malley could beat these guys. The country is not where it was. I feel like we're in a very good shape. I'm looking at least 365 electoral college votes, and that's not to say you shouldn't go out and vote because it's a wrap. No, it's just that people are gonna get out and gonna vote because we're seeing the Republicans on stage, in commercials, on television, just ripping at the country, talking about how bad the country is, how awful the country is, all the while our president and our government is moving along and governing. And I think the Iran deal was absolutely great. He said, "Hey, listen, what did he say? He's going to if you come at me with an open hand instead of a clenched fist, we'll come at you with an open hand as well." And this is what we need to do. We're not petulant children in this country. We should be able to talk to our adversaries as well as our enemies, as well as our allies. You know, at the end of the day, the Empire of Great Britain was our original greatest enemy, and I would beg to say that they're one of our greatest allies right now.
Sure, they're our friends.
Things change. Two world wars, we were sided with Russia in two of them, you know, and now they're supposed to be our enemy. Things change. You know, Iran was one of our friends at one time. You know, things change. And if the Republicans want to stay the same, I'll tell you, know, you're always asking me, what can we do for them? Leave them behind. We have a country to run. We have no time to wait on children with childish things.
Well, that's where we disagree. I'm going to let you go, Carl. Thanks for the call. I want to get to poor Harvey, who's been waiting. You know, the Republicans, those who vote Republican, who vote against their own interests, they're still Americans. They still deserve, you know, the same rights as everyone else. They still deserve a quality of life, you know, that's for themselves and for their family. That's acceptable. You know, that's decent. So that's where I think, and I think they can be appealed to. I truly do. That's where Carl and I have disagreed in the past, and where I agree much more with Douglas on that issue, that they, we can reach out to everyone. That's the whole point of the negotiations, that when we talked to Paul Kawika Martin, we reached out to Iraq, we reached out to Syria, we reached out to ISIS, we reached out to Iran, we reached out to North Korea, and when you do that, you get good results. Let's go to Harvey. Hey, Harvey in Berkeley. Good morning. I want to apologize. Just a sec. We didn't get all of that. So let me just get right back to you. You support Bernie because he's for the commons. You brought up, Harvey, the fact that Walmart is closing stores, so they're actually closing. When I didn't know this, in Oakland or in Berkeley, is that right?
They're closing a store in Oakland because Oakland just raised its minimum wage. That was the headline in the paper.
Do you think that's bad, though? Let's just talk about that for a minute, because the fact that they're closing, doesn't that open up a space maybe for a local business to compete? I mean, a local retailer to compete. The old theory is, and certainly I support it, is when you require businesses, manufacturing companies, like a company that makes widgets, whatever, think of something you use in your everyday life. I don't know, a clothes, a shirt. We raise wages on shirt makers, then you can make the shirt in Haiti, and they are made in Haiti for much less cost. But a supermarket like a Walmart, a store, a superstore, you got to buy your item somewhere. So isn't that maybe good for us if Walmart is closing stores?
Well, essentially, all these mega corporations, it was all mom-and-pop shops originally, and they all couldn't compete with the
Walmart. Walmart crushed them like a bug.
So maybe it'll go the other way. Maybe you can see more mom-and-pop stores opening up, and the money stays in the community. It doesn't just go.
That's why I'm not totally devastated. But, of course, in the short run, the employees of Walmart will be completely without work, and that's a terrible circumstance. Well, they won't necessarily, because a lot of people work at Walmart are working 25, 30 hours, so they're probably also working at 7-Eleven or some other retail. So they may not be totally unemployed because very few people were only working at Walmart, nowhere else. Maybe some of the managers, the store managers, may be out. But, Harvey, bring this up, is this is something that cities should look at, that states counties that say, oh, we're gonna roll out the red carpet for Walmart. We're going to give Walmart everything they want. We're going to give them 10 years without charging them, say, real estate taxes. You know what? They're going to drop you like a bad habit. The second you try to you insist that Walmart pay its fair share to its employees, Walmart's out. This is not somebody you want to tie your future to in any circumstances, Harvey. That's my view.
And my second thing is securing the vote 2016. And in 2015, we saw so much data theft out there. I mean, it was company after company, government entities, everybody was losing data, and it was being stolen. And so I think that it's time to secure the vote and make sure that these data thieves don't grab a hold of the 2016 election numbers and sell it to the highest bidder.
Oh, absolutely. We should just have, forget about all that stuff, we should just have the voting, by paper ballot. But here's the thing, Harvey. Oregon has gone to an all-mail-in voting system, and they've got a 70% participation rate. So by making it really easy, now I don't like voting by mail. Brad Blog has pointed out that it's just too easy to manipulate the votes. Whereas if you put the vote in a big fishbowl, you know, everyone goes into a room in their precinct. They put the vote, they take their ballot, they put it in a fishbowl in the middle of a room. After the voting is closed, the time is closed, you go open up that fishbowl, you put all the ballots on a table, everyone sees it, there are TV cameras everywhere, and you count them. That is the most secure way to have an election. But the thing about the Oregon voting system is 70% participation. In California, you have elections where 33% or less are participating. So how do we get both? How do we get lots of people to vote, but we are absolutely certain that the results that are announced are what the people wanted?
Imagine in the future, Hal, that they're going to have, like, from your cell phone, you're going to have an encrypted government vote, where you can vote from your cell phone. You don't have to go anywhere, you don't have to do anything, and you can vote on the issues directly. The public can vote directly on the issues through their device. And that, I see that as a kind of a future.
Yeah, but how do you know you're
right?
Well, they could cheat, but that could be rigged, right?
I know.
That could be rigged.
It's so tricky. So that's coming up anyways, but so I'm not sure of the answer. I'm just saying we have to not just get enthralled with all the candidates and sort of like just like a flashlight in deer's eyes. We have to look at the whole voting system and mechanism and ensure that our vote counts.
Appreciate the call very, very much. That's Harvey in Berkeley. And, you know, when I look at that participation rate in an off-year election, Oregon got 70%, just at 69.5% of the vote those who were eligible. I believe in 2014, turnout was 69.5%. That is tremendous. That's outstanding. That's extraordinary. Now, I know Blog says that those votes aren't secure, and I'm very, very nervous about that too. But here is what CS Monitor, I think that's Christian Science Monitor, .com says. Another criticism of mail-in ballots is there is more opportunity for voter fraud. Since 2000, and by the way, we know that voter fraud is not a problem. In other words, people who shouldn't be voting aren't voting. That's voter fraud. That doesn't happen. Election fraud is what you have to worry about. Someone stealing the election. But they do address that. So let me read this to you. I don't like that term voter fraud because it's not the right term. But here's what CS Monitor says. Since 2000, 15 million ballots have been cast by mail in Oregon, but there have been only 9 convictions of voter fraud. Brown, I guess that's the Secretary of State, says. The state takes extensive measures to ensure that ballots are secure. Each envelope has a unique barcode. Election officials verify each signature, and there are cameras in every election office to monitor the county. People can also check online to make sure their ballot was counted. That's pretty good. That's pretty good. I don't know how you would. It'd be very difficult. Now, you could have some sort of situation where the ballots are taken or stolen in the mail, that there are letter carriers who are involved, or there are people in post offices who are involved. It is possible. It's certainly more plausible than when you actually have every vote is deposited by hand, and it's a hand filled out, a hand hand voted, hand or ink voted paper ballot. I get that. But this is pretty good. This is pretty darn good. And you're getting 70% participation in an off year. That's amazing. That's extraordinary. That's tremendous. 844-4-HELL-G. 844-367-4254. We have to make it easy for people to vote. I agree with Chris. We should have a voting holiday. You vote. You don't go to work. That day, nobody works on voters on maybe on election day. Well, what about the media? I mean, would I not? I don't know. It should be like a national holiday with, I guess, exceptions for maybe the media and other and those who are considered essential. We're not essential, but except for the media and for government and other. Hey, how about this? We have a 2-day. Election, okay? 2-day election. Every election is on a hand-counted paper ballot. You get 1 day off. Your boss or you decide with your boss which day. You have to get one of the 2 days off. You can't not get a day off. You have to get a day off. So that way, businesses that are essentials, government, police, maybe that's a little tricky because can they work on? Probably they could. Sure. So you have to get your day off. And there could be some exceptions, but very, very few. And it's a 2-day. So Monday, Tuesday elections, and everyone gets one of those 2 days off to vote. Or if you could do it differently, because you could say, well, people want a long weekend. So it's a Friday, Monday election. And you either get Friday off or you get Monday off, period. I like it. I think that's the way we should go. Every vote is on a hand-counted paper ballot. And it's a ballot that you deposit yourself, not by machine. Maybe that you want the machine to print it. People say, well, it's too hard for me. I can't connect the lines, or there's die, a check, or this. Fine. The machine, you put your vote in. The machine prints out the ballot to you. You retrieve it, you look it over and make sure everything is the way you wanted, then you fold it over, and then you drop it in that fishbowl. That's the best way to have an election. That's what we should do. 844-4-HELL-G, 844-367-4254. Dr. King Day, just a little bit more. I know these are snippets. I'm cheating here. This is from YouTube, Martin Luther King Jr. on War. Just a few little snippets because we got more to get to. If you want to join me on this Dr. King Day, 844-4-HELL-G, 844-367-4254. No market reports. The markets are closed. Oh, one other point. I want to thank Radio Monterey. Thank you. RadioMonterey.com, home of shows for the open mind, the home of the Hell Ginsburg Morning Show. So great to be part of their lineup. the Hal Ginsberg Morning Show at Radio Monterey. If you want to call me, 844-4-HAL-G. Dr. King on war.
That I know that justice is indivisible. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere.
With the war, I think the moral force of
Ramsey
Dr.
Clark,
King's
by the way,
opposition,
Justice Department, Attorney General,
had to be an enormous body blow to the president.
We've got some difficult days ahead, but it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you. But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
I make my decisions on the basis of my moral commitment, and I take my ministry very seriously. I would not say that the civil rights movement is dead. It's simply that we are moving to a new phase of the movement. For well now 12 years, we struggle to end legal segregation and all of the humiliation surrounding legal segregation. So it was a struggle for decency. It was a struggle to get rid of extremist behavior toward Negroes. Now we are in a new phase, and that is a phase where we are seeking genuine equality, where we are dealing with hard economic and social.
Beautiful Martin Gay, Marvin Gaye, Martin Luther King, Marvin, beautiful Marvin Gaye song about Dr. King, Abraham, Martin, and John. And we had Dr. King speak in the background during part of that as well. 844-4-HAL-G if you want to join me as we head on towards the end of the show. 844-367-4254. Love to talk to you. And, well, let's go. I was going to say more from the debate here. I just, you know, look, I agree with Carl, I think the country is moving to the left. I think it will be tough for Senator Clinton, if she's elected, to enact the kind of hard right, well, the conservadam, conservative economic policy she champions. But I sure would prefer it be Bernie. And I got John, hold for just a moment. I'll get to you. Here's the from last night's debate.
You know, Governor, you have raised money on Wall Street. You raised a lot of money on Wall Street when you were the head of the Democratic Governors Association.
Yeah, but I haven't gotten a penny
and
this
you
year,
were,
so somebody please. Go on to MartinOMalley.com. Go on to MartinOMalley.com. Send me
By the way,
check.
Give a lot of credit to O'Malley for going after her. Take some bravery. And this is what I hate so much, the deflection. Oh, well, you've gotten money from Wall Street, too. You know what? Please just be honest with us, level with us, Clinton. Just say, yes, 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 I've got my hand out to every billionaire. I'll take anyone's money, and you know what? I'm going to give them something. At least just be honest with us. But the lying, the deflections, the distractions, the false attacks. John, this is the fact that she's winning right now. This sickens me. I can't stand it. Good morning, John.
Hey, good morning. Hey, I wanted to get your take on this new NBC Wall Street Journal poll, because I guess Nate Silver, they get a pretty good rating, just like CBS New York Times, and these are like conflicting.
It's very
polls,
upsetting. You know? It's a very upsetting poll. I talked about this in my email blast yesterday, and I mentioned it on my show a few times. In fact, I just said she's leading, because in large part of that poll that shows her up 25 points, NBC Wall Street Journal. Now, it's somewhat conflicted by their previous poll. Their poll, NBC Wall Street Journal Marist, which shows Sanders beating all the Republicans better than Clinton does. And even in this new poll, he still beats Trump by more than she does. So there does seem to be, like, how can she, I guess I'd say it this way, how can she be winning 59-34, which is what the NBC Wall Street Journal latest poll from yesterday says, John, how can she be winning by 25 if Sanders beats Trump by 15 and she only beats Trump by 10? It does seem a little weird there. I think that poll, my view is that her lead is somewhere between the CBS New York Times poll, which showed it at 7 last week, and 25. I'm going around 15 to 18. I think it's very troubling. I think it's very upsetting. Now, I will also say some other points from what NBC said. They went, I think it skews towards Clinton. The 25-point lead she has is with the most likely voters. I don't know that they use cell phones. I could be wrong, but they based it to a very significant degree, and they said this, on voters who voted in past elections. Now, usually that's fine. You know, it works out, especially because, you know, because you have new voters, and new voters tend to vote in relatively equal numbers for both sides. In this case, that's not the situation at all. The older you are, the more likely you voted in the past, the more likely you're going to vote for Clinton. So the way this poll was conducted may favor Clinton somewhat. All that said, as you point out, NBC Wall Street Journal, very, and you know, look at the names. These are very credible. These are 100-year-old or much older than that in the case of Wall Street Journal institutions, media outlets. They're not going to put their name to something that's crap. So I think you have to be worried when you see that poll. That's all I can say. Hopefully it's a bit of an outlier. Hopefully other polls will show the race much closer. But yes, it worries me, John.
Okay. Well, you know, that's kind of was similar to my take. And I was just, I looked on 538 and I thought, you know, the one thing I thought too is NBC, you know, maybe is, I don't know, biased toward Clinton, but I think you're right. I don't think they would throw anything out there that wasn't accurate. It's just strange
It might not be accurate. They wouldn't put anything out there that's not credible or that's, you know, overtly biased. I mean, we can't play that game where we throw out the information we don't like, unfortunately. I think this poll shows that her scurrilous, dishonest attacks on his health care plan had an effect. That's what I think.
I saw an interesting comment. I'm gonna just say this, and then I'm gonna get on with my day. But this this guy in one of the political groups that I go to, he normally is. I think he you could honestly say that he is kind of an independent moderate. He falls, you know, he could go one way or the other on the issues, and he said, you know, I thought it was interesting to see this last poll and how many people support Hillary. It just shows how many liberals don't actually want a single-payer health care system. You know, and I thought, yeah, that's a very good point. Or to break up the big banks.
I don't think it's quite true the way he described it. I think people are very afraid of anything that upsets the status quo. I would also, you know, and liberals, progressives, I would say the ones who support Clinton are not the liberals. But progressives do see progress made during the Obama administration. I would argue that that progress falls fairly under the description that Dr. King called the tranquilizing drug of gradualism. There's been no change. There's been no revolution. Power has not been wrested from the 1% in any real way. So I would argue that what what we've seen, you know, that's gotten a little better. The job rate, the unemployment rate is a little better. We have more people covered with health care, but it's not transformative in any real way. But I think a lot of liberals, or at least moderate liberals, if there's such a thing, would say, well, we just don't want to jeopardize what we have right now. I think that's more what's going on. And a fear that, you know, maybe she's right somehow, that we don't want to ask for too much. You know what I mean? When Oliver asked for more, right? He wanted more than he was. What happened? They all laughed at him and yelled at him. So, you know, let's be happy with what we've got is kind of the attitude. I think that's what there's some people feeling right now, unfortunately. And that may explain that poll result.
Okay, well, I hope that the polls coming in the weeks to come be something different. But anyhow, take care, Hal. I'll probably talk to you sometime this week.
All right, we'll talk to you again, John. Thanks for the call. And you heard from John. He's despondent. He's worried. He's concerned. And this is exactly, of course, what I worried about when I was saying how the polling looked pretty good last week, how I was getting a little bit more excited, a little bit more upbeat, a little more optimistic. But then the thought is, but don't, you know, the problem is we get excited and then the rug is pulled out from under us. So I don't want us to go too far the other way either. I mean, let's not throw up our hands. Let's not throw in the towel. No. No, there's a fight on our hands. And the numbers still look pretty darn good in New Hampshire. And they still look pretty good in Iowa. And if we can still win both of those, we're in good shape. But they're not quite as, we've got to realize ain't nothing's over yet. All right, let me get back. And of course, Clinton with you take money too, the dishonest attack there. Sanders, let's go back to yesterday's debate, maybe his finest moment.
They're not giving it zero.
Secretary Clinton, and you're not the only one, so I don't mean to just point the finger at you. You've received over $600,000 in speaking fees from Goldman Sachs in 1 year. I find it very strange that a major financial institution that pays $5 billion in fines for breaking the law, not one of their executives is prosecuted, while kids who smoke marijuana get a jail sentence.
NBC News.
That was very powerful right there. Very powerful. And he went on to talk about the contributions that Clinton receives from the giant banks. So there's just really no way to square that with democracy. They don't mesh. They simply don't mesh. And Clinton, you know, she is their, she's their candidate. We have the words. We are comfortable with Clinton. We feel she's one of the better candidates. That is what Wall Street has said. We are comfortable with her. We feel she's a better candidate. That's what they have said, and you cannot square that with democracy. Why do I say that? Because the big banks are a tiny little number of people with an enormous amount of influence and power. And that is anti-democratic. It is that simple. It is anti-democratic. All right, 844-4-HELGY. Just a few more minutes left. 844-367-4254. 844-4-HELGY. I talk about this, explaining white working class Republicans or why Bernie is best. He is the one who will say to the banks, we're going to take money from you. He is the one who said that. And, you know, you cannot believe that Clinton will be on your side when she won't do that. I mean, I don't know how you could. How could you? I mean, what would be your evidence for believing that you will take them on? There ain't none. There ain't none. It's not there. I do think it's a big deal that Sean King, by the way, somebody I have criticized in the past, I think it's a big deal that Sean King endorsed, from Black Lives Matter, endorsed Hillary. I mean, endorse Bernie. I keep doing that. Stop it, Hal. I think it's a big deal. He is going to college campuses, historically black colleges. He's going to campaign for Sanders. Killer Mike is campaigning for Sanders. Will it make a difference? I think it will. Will it make enough of a difference? I hope it will. 844-4-HELL-G. The famous quote, a lot of people give this one. We continue to believe Clinton would be one of the better candidates for financial firms, wrote Jarrett Seberg of Guggenheim Partners. I think people are very excited about Hillary, says one Wall Street investment professional with close ties to Washington. Most people in New York on the finance side view her as being very pragmatic. I think they have confidence that she understands how things work and that she's not a populist. Wow. Well, is that who you want? Is that somebody who understands how things work and isn't a populist? Is that who you want for your next president? Because if you do, I got a great candidate for you named Hillary Clinton. All right. I know probably shouldn't end the show. Well, I won't end the show. I was going to play. I thought it was a very interesting clip by with Pat Buchanan. I will not end the show with this. I will end the show with Dr. King. But I want to at least play a little bit of why, and this is why, by the way, we should elect Sanders to be our Democratic nominee, and why he does better than Clinton against Trump. Or to put it differently, why Clinton doesn't do as well against Trump as Sanders does.
You know, the liberal media mecca, the biased, the clueless elite class on the coast and all that. And that's what he hopes to pounce on in places like Iowa and later when it gets into the southern states like here in South Carolina. What do you think?
I don't think it's working because Donald Trump is very, very strong in South Carolina. Secondarily, Trump's support is really much more working class and middle class than it is wealthy, elite, New York types when you think of Wall Street and the hedge fund folks and the beautiful people. And the folks coming to those rallies, they're enormous, and they don't look like the beautiful people. I think Donald Trump is clearly improving, Neil, as a debater, and I would raise another issue. He really showed some passion and fire also on the issue of economic patriotism and economic nationalism on stopping this export of American jobs. And it's clear from the comments of Governor Kasich and others who are partly agreeing with him that he's driving the party in that direction as well.
All right, so bringing jobs back to this country, not Wall Street, not the beautiful people. That's who Buchanan says are going to the Trump rallies. Well, I think he's probably right because we even read in The Guardian that the people who go to the Trump rallies are scruffy looking. They're rough around the edges. They're not, you know, well dressed by any means. Who's the better candidate to try to appeal to those folks? The guy who wants to take on Wall Street, who's taking them on, or the one who takes from Wall Street, who takes money from Wall Street? I think the answer is obvious. Let's end with, the sublime. The greatest American, I would say, ever.
Mr. Chairman, friends and brothers in this first gathering of the National Conference on New Politics, ladies and gentlemen, can you hear me in the back? I don't know if the Klan is in here tonight or not with all the trouble we're having with these microphones. And seldom, if ever, we're still working with him.
He was having technical problems too, obviously, back in 1965.
I was about to say, seldom, if ever, has such a diverse and truly ecumenical gathering.
Go out with Dr. King's words, and I'm going to be back tomorrow morning. Thanks for listening to my show.
Of politics in our nation. And I want to commend the leadership of the National Conference on New Politics for all of the great work that they have done in making this
significant convention possible. Indeed, by our very nature, we affirm that